is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Early spring wildfires cover parts of North America with smoke. Record temperatures roast the Pacific Northwest again. India and Thailand went into their ninth straight week of unbearable heat, into the mid-40s Celsius, well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Northeast Italy went underwater as 6 months of rain fell in 36 hours, hitting the ground baked hard by persistent drought. That's how it was last week during this decade of climate shift. This week you will hear a couple of my best interviews on wildfires, but first I want to explain why I almost gave up. Doing climate science is like war zone reporting. Sometimes the shells land too close. A few weeks ago, my guests reported two significant developments. First, the engine that drives most of global ocean circulation has already weakened. Dr. Matthew England made this plain in our interview. Essential currents around Antarctica have changed due to global warming. The ramifications are massive and global. The second story, spread over two programs, revealed obscene spending and development plans by fossil fuel companies, all fed by the world's largest investors and banks. They know fossil fuel burning wrecks lives and habitats. But they just made hundreds of billions of dollars doing it, and they want to feed that golden goose to make more. From the Arctic to the Amazon, new wells, pipelines, and shipping ports are fully funded to be built during the next 7 years. Gas industry executives are clear. They expect to keep shipping methane from their products up to and beyond the year 2050. Somehow they persuaded a few governments to call methane clean energy. Never mind unnatural gas production leaks the powerful warming gas methane at every stage of production and distribution. Never mind it is burned into carbon dioxide that lasts hundreds of thousands of years in the heated atmosphere. Earlier in the climate fight, we believed there was time. We expected a decision point, a time frame, when humans would either slash emissions or decide to keep developing, and the rich will adapt somehow, they think. That decision point was always ahead of us, but now it has been made. They have decided. Right out in the open, blessed by governments who claim green awareness, fossil fuel companies have committed us all to a world at least 3 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial times. So why bother? The future is planned and paid for, but it is not cast in stone. We did not decide to fry the world to make billions homeless. About 60 people in the largest fossil fuel companies and countries decided to continue building their profitable operation. It's like a drug gang. They are supported by hundreds in big banks and investment houses. They donate a lot to politicians. They threaten economic ruin if they don't get their way. But things can be called off. The Disney Corporation just canceled a $1 billion project in Florida. In Canada in 2020, Teck Resources canceled its $20 billion tar sands mine after protests. In 2021, the Keystone XL pipeline was halted when U.S. President Joe Biden revoked a key permit. Just because a few corporations and national companies say they are going to produce dangerous fossil fuels doesn't mean we have to let it happen. Some countries can still vote for change. Others may need revolution. Billions of people depend on stopping the new surge of fossil fuel production.
Radio EcoShock.
When I began to broadcast Radio EcoShock, starting with CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere hit an ominous level of 381 parts per million in the atmosphere. On May 9, 2013, CO2 levels in the air reached the level of 400 parts per million, according to NASA. That was a scary time. And this week, the air holds 421 parts per million, according to NOAA, and 423 per the Bloomberg carbon clock. We're already well into the danger zone, my friends. Investors and governments can choose to fund renewable energy or fossil fuels. Each of us can make that decision better and faster by reducing our fossil fuel burning. It's hard. You stop flying, but what about when your brother is dying 2,000 miles away? UK author George Monbiot hit this right in his 2006 book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. In his book presentation in Vancouver, recorded by Radio EcoShock, of course, Monbiot pointed to the thorny problem of love miles.
The actions which are causing this problem are actions which hitherto have been considered either entirely innocent or positively beneficial. Making a cup of tea for the next door neighbours, picking up your kids from school, flying to New York for your brother's wedding. Under the old pre-climate change moral code, all those were good things, morally good things. Under the new moral code demanded by climate change, they're also bad ones. And we find that what climate change does is to present us with the spectacle of two valid moral codes in irreconcilable antagonism. When you look at that last example of flying over to your brother's wedding in New York, you see an instance of what could be the most intractable of all causes of climate change, the phenomenon I call love miles. Love miles are the distance between yourself and the people you love. To redeem those love miles, you must travel. And that traveling is the fastest growing cause of environmental destruction. We see in this phenomenon that the planet could be destroyed by love.
That's the travel that results from families now spread across continents or even the world. These might be the last fossil fuels you and I burn, until fossil-free flight or bullet trains are available. Monbiot suggests we should choose mates living near to us for marriage so that new families can continue to meet without travel. We know during the 50s and 60s, corporate culture encouraged and then demanded families move around the country. The military does the same. Families were split up. And now we know there is a cost to the atmosphere, and that needs to be reversed. Localism may be the survival mode, as it was in medieval times, the last age before coal. If we can't change, you and I, then like the fossil fuel companies, we have already decided we will keep our ill-gotten gains, our frantic, supposedly easier lives. They can take our fossil addiction from our dead hands, we say, and that may literally happen. That's where science can help. The whole process of science is built on doubt. We realize our grasp of actuality is foggy. It's filled with preconceptions and wishes and superstitions. So we test against the physical world, measuring all sorts of things, checking and rechecking, and then recognizing possible error. That tells us, for example, that wildfire smoke is not neutral for climate change. For years, experts said fires are natural in nature. Wildfire smoke may cool local weather for a few days, but trees are adapted to fire and the forest will regrow. Some said the younger forest would capture more carbon than the mature trees that had burned. That was a cycle, and we don't need to worry about it, so long as homes did not burn down. That comforting narrative is being disproved by new science. Wildfires can change large weather systems. An article published in October 2022 found, quote, "The heat and aerosols generated by wildfires in the western United States can intensify severe weather in the central United States." Tornadoes, anybody? Storms? Let's look at boreal forest fires, the giant firestorm sweeping across northern Canada and Russian Siberia. The headline, "Study reveals record high carbon dioxide emissions from boreal fires in 2021. They say boreal fires, which typically account for 10% of global fire carbon dioxide emissions, contributed 23% in 2021, end quote. The Copernicus Atmospheric Monitoring Service reports this year's fires are not as extreme as some previous years. With their satellite eyes, CAMS reports this about fires in Russia, quote, "As for central and eastern Russia, seasonal fire activity started in April, but has increased during the first week of May. The data show fires actively burning in a band stretching from Russia's Chelyabinsk region across Omsk and Novosibirsk regions and into the Far East, also affecting Kazakhstan and Mongolia. Despite the increased daily total in these regions of Russia, it is worth noting that the total estimated wildfire carbon emissions for April and May are below average for the period as of May 9th. CAM senior scientist Mark Parrington told the press, "The scale and intensity of current fires are reflecting increased fire risk following some weeks of drier than usual conditions. Wildfires are not particularly unusual in the boreal forest spring, and we have monitored fires in both Canada and Eurasia at this time of year in the past," end quote. Parrington has been a guest on this program. By comparison to the worst records, this is not a panic year in their view. But then they say Northern Hemisphere fires this year have the highest carbon emissions since 2019. Quote, "The CAMS data put carbon emissions from wildfires in Alberta at just over 5 megatons so far this year, which means that the province's carbon emissions are already the highest since the extreme fires experienced in May 2019, in which over 880,000 hectares were burned and the resulting smoke was transported across the Atlantic Ocean," end quote. So forest fires do add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and contribute to warming. Whether some of that carbon will be recaptured depends on regrowth of the northern forests, which is not guaranteed given increasing extremes of heat and drought. Sometimes forests never come back. Whether or not the carbon is recaptured, record amounts of carbon into the atmosphere from burning forests comes at the very worst time. Time is key here. With only a few years left to stop extinction-level warming, any greenhouse gases from any source pumps up the heat engine that begins to feed itself. Global warming can lead to more and faster global warming. Several scientists here on Radio EcoShock, especially Tim Lenton and Johan Rockström, identified dozens of tipping points, those feedback loops that humans can never stop. Four major tipping points are likely to be triggered when the global mean temperature crosses 1.5 degrees C for any length of time. The World Meteorological Organization just issued a press release saying Earth would cross that 1.5 degree mark one of these years within the next 5 years. With the developing El Niño, that atmospheric milestone could come as early as 2025. We are in a drastic situation. Drastic action is required. The heat goes right down the Pacific coast. All kinds of heat records were broken in Portland, Oregon in early May. Vancouver, cool, coastal Canadian Vancouver, hit 33 degrees C in the suburbs, feeling like 36 degrees or 96.8 Fahrenheit. That would be rare in August there. It does not happen in early May. And all that sounds cool compared to 45 degrees or 113 in Thailand for a few weeks. Japan was just sweating it out, but the G7 leaders there did not discuss global warming. Why would they? What is there to talk about? Everybody at the table has big energy backers. Nobody wants to rock the fragile economic boat. Large-scale society is paralyzed as big changes wash over us. Say, find out about the Extinction Rebellion movement. See what you can do.
How bad is it?
It's so bad, Harvard Magazine just published an article titled "Financing Climate Adaptation and Deciding What to Let Go." Author Jonathan Shaw says, quote, "The economic scale of the required economic adaptation is beyond anything the public sector could possibly afford to fund. Triage, cutting losses, is a necessary part of any sensible climate response." Well, of course it is. We all knew it would come to this. The rich elite admits climate change is now unstoppable. We can't save everything. So they presume to set their priorities for the rest of 7 or 8 billion people. Harvard must be saved, of course, even though their multi-billion dollar endowment fund refused to divest from fossil fuels. They invested in wrecking the future of students they allegedly train for the future. Many universities still do, although a student-driven divest movement is growing. Keep it up. Maybe this is why multi-billionaires seem to want fascism so badly. They know crowd control will be needed when humans rebel. They need a belief system that allows hundreds of millions of others to be displaced or killed in poorer parts of the world, along with the poor maybe in their own countries. Repeated climate change could lead to a more fair world or one that is much more unjust. That we don't know yet. I'm working on some interviews with surprising news about how this planet actually works. Those interviews will appear periodically, interspersed with replays. You know, along with an overflowing river of climate news, I have family members that need help for a week or two. I will be in and out of studio and then back in full production. You can email me with your comments or interview suggestions. Please do. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. radio@ecoshock.org. I may not respond to everybody, but I do read every single message. Listeners have led me to some great guests. We will hear from one of them now. This interview with Dr. Mike Flanagan is from Radio EcoShock, May 27th, 2011.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Unreported and uncontrolled fires in Canada's boreal forest burn vast areas every year. As the North heats faster than the rest of the world due to climate change, these fires are hotter and wilder, even creating their own weather systems. In a possible sign of the future, on May 15, 2011, with only minutes warning, really, the 7,000 residents of Slave Lake, Alberta, were forced to flee a wall of oncoming flames. One-third of the town, including the municipal building and library, burned to the ground. A week later, residents were still living in evacuation centers. Wildfires are back in the news. The recognized expert is Dr. Mike Flanagan, a senior researcher with Natural Resources Canada, an expert for the Canadian Forest Service, and professor of wildland fire at the University of Alberta. Dr. Flanagan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Mike, I thought summer was fire season. These big fires in Canada's north so early in the spring, is that unusual?
Not for Alberta. We do get spring fires in Alberta. After the snow melts, there's about a four-week window where things are dry on the ground and the vegetation hasn't turned green. It hasn't greened up yet. And during this period, fires are fairly common in Alberta.
And could you tell us, why was the town of Slave Lake surprised by such a monster fire?
Well, I don't want to dwell on specifics like Slave Lake because I don't have all the information on Slave Lake. But what I can tell you is that fires can move rapidly when there's strong winds and dry weather like we've had in Alberta the last few weeks. So fires can move quickly, and if communities are in the path, they are at risk.
And I was surprised, you don't need to have a long-term drought to have a fire risk. These forests can dry out fairly quickly, is that right?
Well, much of the boreal, especially the boreal shield, has very shallow soils, such that there's a memory of only a few days to a week in those forest fuels. Regardless of how much rain you've had before that, if you have a week of warm, dry, windy weather, you can have a raging inferno. It's the forest fuels that really drives the fire situation. If the fuels get dry, fires can start and fires can spread.
And what part does the Rocky Mountain pine bark beetle play in this?
Well, I'm a fire person and not a bug person, but I have done a bit of reading on this, and vast areas of BC interior, mountain pine beetle has killed lodgepole pine. Now, these pine trees die, and they're standing there. Eventually, the wind will blow them over. But while they're standing, their needles go from an orange to a red to a gray. And during these periods, we are concerned about fire behavior, and this is a course of active investigation. And particularly the gray stage, which is 3 to 5 years after the death of the tree, the needles that are still left can spread quite quickly and cause spot fires in advance of the fire, so make it kind of accelerating the fire front. So it's it's a very dangerous situation if a fire gets up and running in these mountain pine beetle killed stands.
And I've read that climate scientists have predicted greater warming in the north, of course, in Canada and Russia and Alaska. Does that therefore lead to more fires or more intense fires? And is that actually happening yet?
Yes. And I'll just, if I can back up just a little bit, I'll answer that question. There's kind of three or four factors that influence fires. The first is, we kind of touched on it, is the fuels and what type of fuel. Conifers burn easily, deciduous less so. How dry the fuels are important. Ignition, people, and lightning are the main agents of fire starts. And the third factor is weather, which I consider to be the most important. Hot, dry, windy weather are very important to fires. Now, in the future, the climate models, general circulation models, suggest that we're going to be a much warmer world, especially in northern latitudes, Russia, Siberia, Alaska, Canada. And with warmer temperatures come longer fire seasons, as fires will start earlier in the spring and go later in the fall. With warmer temperatures, there'll be more lightning activity. More lightning activity, the more fire starts you have. And the last reason is, the warmer it gets, the more evapotranspiration we have, and which means the fuels will be drier unless there's significant changes in precipitation, significant increases in precipitation. And for every degree Celsius warming, you need about a 10% increase in precipitation during summer. So much of northern Canada is looking at 4 to 6 degrees Celsius warming. You need an increase of 46% in precipitation, which the models don't suggest, though our confidence in precipitation is less than temperature. The end result is that the fuels are drier, which means it's easier for fires to start and spread.
Yes, this is something I've had trouble understanding, because I've seen predictions that the northern limits will be actually growing wetter and wetter, and in past ages they were even tropical, almost humid forests. So how do we then get more forest fire activity out of that wet situation?
With the Arctic Ocean, the ice pack becoming seasonal, there will be more precipitation, especially in the autumn when the water is still open. You get kind of a lake effect or sea effect snowfall or rain event. But during the fire season, the warm season, as long as you have periods of drought, you can have forest fires. And with climate change, we expect more extreme weather, more extreme droughts, more extreme flooding. And when those droughts occur, fires can happen. And fires are not just restricted to the forest. We have a new study with NASA looking at tundra fires. And there's been some very large tundra fires in the last few years. And these appear to be becoming more common.
And for those who don't know what tundra is, what does that mean for us?
Well, tundra, it's so cold that trees cannot grow, generally because there's no summer warmth for the seed to be viable and for seedlings to be established. There's permafrost, that is, underneath the organic material, there's ice all year long. And there's grasses, forbs, herbs, and occasionally shrubs. And this is tundra. And there's also, interesting, a lot of hydrates that are stored in the permafrost. And if the warming continues and permafrost melts, these hydrates, methane, will be released, which are very effective greenhouse gases.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Canadian fire expert Dr. Mike Flanagan. Mike, how do we know that climate change is involved in wildfires? Who is doing research on this?
Well, there's a number of people around the world looking at this. In Canada, we've been working on it since the mid-1980s, if you can believe it, which is 25 years now, plus. And, you know, we've published work that suggests that the increases we've seen in fire activity in Canada is already the result of human-caused climate change. For example, in Canada, our average area burned in the 60s and 70s was about 1 million hectares a year. Currently, we burn about 2 million hectares a year, which is a doubling. 2 million hectares is about half the size of Nova Scotia, approximately the size of Massachusetts, to give it some context. And we've done a number of studies that suggest by the end of this century, we expect another doubling of area burned. In some papers for western North America, Alaska, BC, Yukon, increases could be as high as fivefold, so five times more fire than we currently see.
That's a whole new landscape for living you're describing. You know, back in November 2007, I interviewed Dr. Tom Gower. He said Canada's boreal forests are no longer a carbon sink. They are a net source of global warming gases. I know that's a huge question, but I want to ask if you would agree with that, and do wildfires add to the carbon burden, or are they kind of carbon neutral?
It's actually disturbances like insects and fire that make our boreal forest a carbon source rather than a sink. And the larger aspect is that about 20% of our boreal forest is wetlands or peatlands. And with more drought, these will become vulnerable to burning. And they store vast amounts of carbon, and it's kind of a legacy carbon. It's been building up over thousands and thousands of years. And greenhouse gas releases from these peat fires can be significant on the global scale. Previous studies done in Indonesia suggest that peat fires in Indonesia released 20 to 40% of global fossil fuel emissions in 1 year. And the peat reserves, the peat and carbon reserves in Canada and Siberia completely dwarf anything in Indonesia. So if these peatlands begin to burn, they burn already, and they go into the ground, they smolder, and they can burn right through winter and then start up again in the spring. With more extreme droughts, more and more of these peatlands could burn and release significant amounts of greenhouse gases, which would feed the warming, a positive feedback, if you like.
Well, what about wildfires further south? In BC, the city of Kelowna, with almost 250,000 people, has been threatened by fire twice. And if the planet heats up as predicted, well, we had the Russian capital was threatened in 2010. Do you think major cities will be at more risk from uncontrollable fires?
Anywhere where there's communities or people in the forest or near the bush, they are at risk. And with global warming, climate warming, we expect this risk to increase. And we only have to look around the globe. It's not just a Canadian situation. In recent years, there's been fires in Russia, as you mentioned. The year before, February 2009, there were catastrophic fires in Australia. There's been catastrophic fires in Greece, in California. This is a global phenomenon, and it's only going to get worse.
Well, how do we need to rethink fires and fire planning in response to that?
There's already a few strategies at hand to help communities as well as homeowners. In Canada, it's called FireSmart. In the United States, it's called FireWise. And these are guidelines to help homeowners protect their homes. And a lot of it's just common sense. Don't have cedar shakes on your roofs. Most homes build down because of embers falling on the rooftop and the roof catching fire. Also, do not stack firewood against your home. Don't have burnable shrubs near your right adjacent to your house. Things like that. But also for communities, building fire guards around the community. And by that, we mean reducing the fuels close to town or the community. And this can be done mechanically, by chainsaws and just removing the forest fuels, putting pavement in if you like, or grass and sprinklers. And you can also use prescribed burning to burn the regions adjacent to communities to protect them from fire in the future. So I often say you can have a little smoke now in a managed way or a lot of smoke later in an uncontrolled fashion.
Right. Well, as we wrap up, do you have any tips on good articles or websites about wildfires that our listeners could go to?
Well, there's the Canadian Forest Service has an excellent website on fire. And if you just say Canadian Forest Service Wildland Fire, it should get you there. I don't have the website right beside me, but if you Google or Bing that, I'm sure it will get there. Or Canadian Wildland Fire Information System should get you there as well.
Thank you so much. We'll have to wrap up there. Our guest on Radio EcoShock has been Canadian wildfire expert Dr. Mike Flanagan. He was editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Wildland Fire from 2002 to 2008. He's been a leader with the U.S. National Assessment on Global Change and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's got over 200 published papers in his career so far. So, Dr. Flanagan, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
That was Canadian fire expert Michael Flanagan, first broadcast in May 2011, and still true 12 years later.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio.
for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is